Okay, so we'll chant the Sanskrit mantras to the Ishopanishads, which is on your pink tab. She said, I want to be in a class. The magic word. Wow. She's as smart as her dad. Not as smart as her mom, though. Here we are giving her lots of attention. So, okay. So all together, huh? Oh, we don't have Ragini here for our tone. How does he do it? Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Yisarvashamidam Sarvam Yatkinta jagatam jagat tenak taktena bunjita madgrida kashasvidanam kurvaneva karmani jijivisek chitam samaha evam twai nanyate tosti na karma lepenare asurya namate loka andena tamasavrita tamste pya bigacchanti ye ke chat mahano jana anejadekam manaso javiyo nainade devam apnivam parvam marasat tadavatonyan atayeti tishtat tasmin apo matarishva dadati tad ejati tad naijati tadure tadvantike Taranantarasya sarvasya taru sarvasya yabhuyataha yastu sarvani bhutani atma yevanupashyati sarva bhuteshu chatmanam tato na vijagupshyate yasmin sarvani bhutani atma evadbhud vijanata tatyoko mohako soka Ekatvam anupasyataha saparyagach chukram akamyam avarnam ashnam viram sudam apapavidam kavir manisi paribhu swayambur yatat yatato nyata vidajach chasvatabhya samavya andam tama pravishyanti ye vidyam upasate Tato buya evate tamo ya uvidyayam rataha Anyad evahur avidyaya Nanyad ahur avidyaya Iti shushrum madiranam Inastad vijachakshare vidyam cha yas Tad vedo bayam saha Avidyayam nitya tirtva Vidya yamritamasnute andantama pravishyanti ye sambutim upasate tato buya evate tamo ya usambutyam rataha anyad evahur asambhavat anyad ahur asambhavat iti shushrumadiranam inastad vijachakshare Sambutim cha vinasam cha yastad vedo bayam saha vinasena mritya tirtva sambujat mrityam asnute hiranmanyena patrena satya sahpihitam mukam tatvam pasyam apavrinu satya dharma yadrishyate purushane karshe yama surya prajapatya Vyuha rasmin samuha tejo yate rupam kalyanatama tate pashami yos vaiso purusham soham asmi vayuranilam amritam atendam basmatam sariram om krato smara kritam smara krato smaram kritam smara agne naya supantaraya asman Vishvani deva vayunani vidvan yujo yashmaja juhurana meno Buishtam te nama uptam videma. Hey, not bad. No, that's right. We can just read these. Hare Krishna yokoso. The personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, and because he is completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced of the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because he is the complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. Everything animate or inanimate that is within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he goes on working in this way. For that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man. The killer of the soul, whoever he may be, must enter into the planets known as the worlds of the faithless, full of darkness and ignorance. Although fixed in his abode, the personality of Godhead is swifter than the mind and can overcome all others by running. The powerful demigods cannot approach him. Although in one place, he controls those who supply the air and the rain. He surpasses all in excellence. The Supreme Lord walks and does not walk. He is far away, but he is very near as well. He is within everything, and yet he is outside of everything. He who sees everything in relationship to the Supreme Lord, who sees all living entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything or any being. One who always sees all living entities as spiritual sparks, in quality one with the Lord, becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or an anxiety for him? Such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has fulfilled everyone's desires since time immemorial. Those who engage in the culture of Nessian activities shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. The wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. Only one who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. Those who are engaged in the worship of the demigods enter into the darkest region of ignorance, and still more so do the worshippers of the impersonal absolute. It is said that one result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes, and that another result is obtained by worshipping what is not supreme. All this is heard by the undisturbed authorities who clearly explained it. One should know perfectly the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna and his transcendental name, form, qualities, and pastimes, as well as the temporary material creation with its temporary demigods, men, and animals. When one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it. In the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge. O my Lord, sustainer of all that lives, your real face is covered by your dazzling effulgence. Kindly remove that covering and exhibit yourself to your pure devotee. O my Lord, O primeval philosopher, maintainer of the universe, O regulating principle, destination of the pure devotees, well-wisher of the progenitors of mankind, please remove the effulgence of your transcendental rays so that I can see your form of bliss. You are the eternal supreme personality of Godhead, like unto the sun as I am. Let this temporary body be burnt to ashes, and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, O my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices, because you are the ultimate beneficiary. Please remember all that I have done for you. O my Lord, as powerful as fire, omnipresent one, now I offer you all obeisances, falling on the ground at your feet. O my Lord, please lead me on the right path to reach you. And since you know all that I have done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past sins, so that there will be no hindrance to my progress. Wow, so nice. Okay, pick a verse that you'd like to read the purport to. Mantra 8. Is that the one with no veins? Oh. Oh, yeah. It's about the topmost devotee. Well, no, the top. It's describing, I think in this purport, Prabhupada will explain the different levels of devotees. And the topmost devotee is one who has this vision, you know. Called the Uttama Adhikari or the Mahabhagwat. Or sometimes Prabhupada says the first class devotee. Would you like to read it with the microphone? Starting with the Sanskrit. Well, I'll do my best. We can do it together again. Saparya gachchukram akanyam avanam ashnam viram sudam apapavidam kavir manishi paribur swayambur yatata yato nrata yadvadach chavirakshabhya samabhya. Okay. So, sa, that person, pariyagat, must know in fact, sukram, the omnipotent, akayam, unembodied, avranam, without reproach, ashnaviram, without veins. See? Yeah, see, it's a body without veins. Sudam, antiseptic. Apapavidam, prophylactic. Kavi, omniscient. Manisi, philosopher. Paribhu, the greatest of all. Swayambhu, self-sufficient. Yatata yata, just in pursuance of. Artan, desirables. Vyadadat, awards. Sashvatibhya, immemorial. Samabhya, time. So this isn't the verse you were thinking then, right? This is the verse. Okay. So go ahead.
Such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is embodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher, who has been fulfilling everyone's desires since time immemorial.
Okay, well, and also, if anyone has a question or wants to say something between us here.
Purport. Here is a description of the transcendental and eternal form of the Absolute Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Lord is not formless. He has his own transcendental form, which is not at all similar to the forms of the mundane world. The forms of the living entities in this world are embodied in material nature, and they work like any material machine. The anatomy of a material body must have a mechanical construction with veins and so forth, but the transcendental body of the Supreme Lord has nothing like veins. It is clearly stated here that he is unembodied, which means that there is no difference between his body and his soul. Nor he is forced to accept a body according to the laws of nature, as we are. In materially conditioned life, the soul is different from the gross embodied and subtle mind. For the Supreme Lord, however, There is never any such difference between him and his body and mind. He is the complete whole, and his mind, body, and he himself are all one and the same.
Yeah, I would like to stop there. And just, it's interesting, you know, how this verse is describing the body of the Lord, and it particularly points out that there's no veins. And so, you know, veins are a very mechanical thing. I have good veins. Usually girls' veins are harder to see than boys' veins because they have, women actually have an extra layer of fat cells along the skin. Actually, women's bodies are stronger than men's bodies in a lot of ways. And that's one of the ways they can take cold better because of that. They're less prone to hypothermia. But anyway, you can see veins, and you can, you know, it's very mechanical when they do what's called a coronary artery bypass graft, like President Kennedy just had. He had one about 6 years ago, but his graft is starting to wear out. He went into the hospital last week because he was having chest pains. And so they had, I think you only have 4 or 5 major coronary arteries. So you have arteries that come out and go back into the heart and supply the heart muscle. Just like you have arteries that go down, you have your major arteries that go down your arms and go down your legs. And the arteries are what bring blood to the tissue. And the veins bring the blood back to the heart. Right? So the arteries are very thick and muscular. They actually pulse. And they have a very thick, they call it a lumen. Right? And the veins are actually thinner, and they have these little valves that allow blood to go back up to the heart, but don't allow the blood to back up and go back the other way. Right? So it's very mechanical, right? So what they do when they do a bypass graft is they take the largest vein out of the leg, which is that runs down the inside of your leg. It's called a saphenous vein. And they take that and they hook it up to where the arteries hook up into the heart, and they bypass those arteries and they use that big vein. But if you have a lifestyle, you know, that's unhealthy or genetically for whatever reason, those veins start to clog up even faster than your original coronary arteries. So that's what happened to Clinton. Already after 6 years, that vein that they used to bypass his coronary arteries is already filling up with sludge. And so they put in a stent, which is a little like piece of mesh that holds the vein open. So it's very, very... yeah. But Krishna, he doesn't have veins. So it's actually, it's interesting because the spiritual bodies, they appear like material, or you could say that the material bodies appear like the spiritual, but the spiritual bodies are light, spiritual light, conscious light that have a form, but not a mechanical form. And so there's eating, but there's no passing stool, you know, and there's seeing and there's sense perception, but any of the senses can replace the other senses. But just like it's described in the, there's one book, called the Madhurya Kadambini by Srila Viswanatha Chakravarti. He is in the line of our spiritual masters. He was present here about 250 years ago. He's kind of right in between when Lord Chaitanya left and where we are now. And he wrote a lot of the major commentaries on the Bhagavatam, and we get a lot of like inside information from him in his commentaries. We find out a lot about the spiritual world, and what certain things in the Bhagavatam mean. And so he wrote this one book called Madhurya Kadambini, which describes the process that you go through. It's like reading his personal progress as a devotee from the very beginning of faith to the time where the holy name reveals himself to the devotee. And at the stage of bhava, right before prema, the name begins to reveal itself to all the senses. So the first one hears the form of the Lord in the name. Right? Then he sees the form of the Lord in the name. Then he smells the form of the Lord in the name and tastes the form of the Lord in the name and touches the form of the Lord in the name. And then simultaneously all the senses are experiencing the form of the Lord simultaneously. And it's said that your material body couldn't handle the total experience, that you have to have a spiritual body in order to be able to contain that amount of bliss. But it's just describing how the form of the Lord is a spiritual form, and how the form of the name and the form of the form who has the name are not different, and how they are revealed to the spiritual senses of a devotee in his spiritual body. And so we have that spiritual body, and we have spiritual senses, but they're covered over by the mind and by the material senses, and so we're identifying with those. But nonetheless, the actual perception, the perceiver, the knower, the witness, is the self. It's never anything material, even though it appears that way. You know? So what's seeing is not the eye, you know, and what is hearing is not the ear. Of course, you know, there's some light stimulation that goes into the retina and that goes to the optic nerve to the brain and stimulates nerve cells and chemical reactions, and there's some image that appears in the mind, and all the senses are like that. And that's total mechanical, and that can be manipulated, you know, by scientists. They do it with rats all the time. You know, they stimulate different parts of the brain and get certain reactions. And you can do the same thing with a human being. They have these brain surgeries. You know, in brain surgery, the patient has to be awake. Because before they go into the brain, if they're working on certain problems, they have to do what's called brain mapping, because everyone's brain is mapped out just a little bit differently. So they got to make sure that they're going into the right part of the brain to do what they have to do. So they actually have to talk to the patient as they're going into the brain, but the brain doesn't have any pain sensors. So we have pain sensors in our fingers and everywhere else in our body, but the brain cells themselves don't have any pain. So they're going in there and touching the brain and everything and talking to the patient, but they're not feeling anything, even though the top of their skull is is cut off. Yeah. So they can go in there and they can stimulate memories, you know, and they can cause the patient to remember when they were 2 years old at their first birthday party, you know, and they can recall every tiny little detail from, you know, if it was a little girl to the pretty little dress she was wearing to the mean kid who called her a name or whatever. All those memories are there, and they can be unlocked just by stimulating, you know, a certain part of the brain. And that's all mechanical. But the actual perception, ultimately, the consciousness is the perceiver of whatever is heard or whatever is seen or whatever picture in the mind is there. And that always goes back to the self, even though it will appear like it's you know, the material sense of hearing or the material sense of sight. the actual, you know, cognition or perception is the self. And that's always transcendental, no matter what the form, you know, from a, it might be an ant or it might be a human being. But that perceiver, the perception, is pure consciousness. And so the Lord has a spiritual form. And it's specifically mentioned in this verse, no veins. So we get the point, you know, that it's not mechanical. And it's just for experiencing bliss and relationships. And that this world is, and the body is just a reflection of the spiritual. The forms in this world are just reflections of the spiritual forms. Even in the Bible it says that man was created in the image of God. But it's in this world it's an image. It's not the real thing. It's not the reality. So in this world the bodies are all mechanical. And they're worked on, just, you know. When I used to work on patients sometimes, it became very routine. You know, a lot of times they were unconscious. And unfortunately, sometimes my mentality was more like I was working on a car than a person, although they gave us training in a lot of ways to help us not become that way. Just like if we were putting a tube into somebody, we were supposed to hold our breath so that we knew what it was like to not be without oxygen for 15 seconds or 30 seconds. We weren't supposed to go over 15 seconds. If we couldn't get the tube in 15 seconds, then we had to give the patient more, you know, oxygen, ventilation, and then try again. But this whole idea of putting a tube, you know, putting medicine into veins is a total mechanical thing. And women, it was always more difficult to find their veins because of that extra level of fat tissue in the skin. Yeah, so people probably miss you a lot, huh? And it was hard with children, too. Yeah. Okay, so we're reading Isha Upanishad, verse 8, and we're on the second paragraph. And Priya's reading.
I have a question.
Page 56. Okay, you have a question? Yeah.
The Lord's form in the spiritual world and the Lord's form, Krishna, when he comes to this planet in Vrindavan, his body, is it different?
Well, Krishna, he answers that in the Bhagavad Gita. And no, it's not. But we should probably read the verse just to clarify that. In the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains about his appearance because Arjuna asked him about it. Krishna had told Arjuna that he had come before, that he told this science to the sun god Vivaswan millions of years ago. And Arjuna was under the impression that Krishna and him were, you know, friends, you know, about the same age. So he was saying, how is it possible that you came, you know, millions of years ago? How is it that you're senior to birth? You know, so then Krishna gave the opportunity to explain how his body is transcendental. So let's look at four. Ajopi sanavi atma bhutanami ishwarupis. That's six. Well, let's read 5 and 6. Page 197. Krishna says the personality of Godhead said, many, many births, both you and I have passed. I can remember all of them, but you cannot, O subduer of the enemy. And then he says in the next verse, Ajopi san avayatma bhutanam ishwaropi san prakritim swam adishtaya samavami atmamayaya. Although I am unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all living entities, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. So he says, I am unborn, my body never deteriorates. I appear in my original transcendental form.
So do the residents of Vrindavan, his activities are not normal like the functions of the body, or they are?
Well, it depended if you were under what others were, how people were viewing Krishna according to their relationship with him and to whether they were devotees or not. And it's mentioned that when Krishna entered the arena of Kamsa, when he was going to wrestle with the wrestlers, when Krishna and Balaram entered, there was arena, you know, the audience was filled with all different types of beings, right? There were yogis there. There were impersonalists there. There were devotees there. There were demons there. And each one saw Krishna and Balaram differently. Said the yogis saw Krishna and Balaram as the Paramatma. And the impersonalists saw them as Brahman, manifested. And the gopis saw them as, you know, their lover. And Kamsa saw Krishna as death personified. And so not everyone, many people who saw Krishna thought that he was just a normal king. And so they fought with him. And so it's like always, you know, Krishna reveals himself according to the love or not that we have for him or don't have for him. All right, let's continue on here. So we're on page 56.
In the Brahma Samhita 5.1, there is a similar description of the Supreme Lord. He is described there as Satchidananda Vigraha, which means that he is the eternal form fully representing transcendental existence, knowledge, and bliss. As such, he does not require a separate body or mind, as we do in material existence. The Vedic literature clearly states that the Lord's transcendental body is completely different from ours, that he is sometimes described as formless. This means that he has no form like ours and that he is devoid of a form we can conceive of. In the Brahma Samhita 5.32, it is further stated that with each and every part of his body, he can do the work of the other senses. This means that the Lord can walk with his hands, accept things with his legs, see with his hands and feet, eat with his eyes, etc. In the Shruti Mantras, it is also said that although the Lord has no hands and legs like ours, he has a different type of hands and legs, by which he can accept all that we offer him and run faster than anyone. These points are confirmed in this eighth mantra through the use of words like Shukram, omnipotent.
How are we so far? This is really an important point too, because when we think of the Lord's form or our spiritual form from a material point of view, it's inconceivable. Because our forms, you know, in the material world, even though they're mechanical, they appear, you know, functional, right? You know, we have a mouth so that we can eat food, you know, and we can eat food with our hands, you know. Whereas Krishna, he can eat food with his hands or with his eyes. He doesn't need a mouth. So if he doesn't need a mouth, then why have a mouth? So that's the materialistic thinking. And ultimately, in the material world, all form is changing. And every form has a beginning and has an end. So that's all we can conceive of. We can't conceive of an eternal form. And it doesn't appear from a material point of view to even be a necessity. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, contemplating my death. Maybe it's because I'm getting older. I think about it even more than when I used to work, and I used to see death every day when I worked. And I was thinking that at death, you know, that everything becomes equal. You know, when we're in this world, we're always comparing ourselves to each other, men comparing themselves to women comparing themselves to to men, and you know, somebody's rich, somebody's poor, somebody's beautiful, somebody's ugly, somebody's fat, somebody's thin, and we're so concerned about these things, and we're consumed, you know, with these thoughts. But in the end, it doesn't matter how famous you are, how rich you were, or how intelligent you were, Hare Krishna. The end result is the same for everybody, exactly the same. You know, it becomes a rotting, the body becomes a rotting corpse that eventually turns to dust, and that dust eventually, you know, returns. All the elements return to their source. The water goes back to the water, the air goes back to the air, the earth goes back to the earth. Actually, it's never separated. It just appears that way, and illusory. But the water is always connected to the water, and so is the air. But at the end, you know, the death is the great equalizer. And that all that, the material form and the identity with that form is never seen again. When Srila Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, he was all alone and struggling, you know, to produce the Back to Godhead magazine, and he was doing his translations. And it wasn't always, you know, sometimes he became depressed and he was struggling. It wasn't like he was always in a state of bliss, but there was a lot of hardship. And at one point, you know, you've heard the story where he was in Delhi distributing his magazines store to store, and a bull with his horns gored him in the side and severely injured him. And he began to question, you know, his choice, you know, to leave the family and to go to Vrindavan, thinking, well, was I really supposed to do this? Maybe this wasn't what I was supposed to do. And then he wrote this, he wrote a poem about the how fragile this life is. And then he was looking over, he had a whole list of his family members, you know, and past and present. And he saw that all the family members had now, for him, had just become a list of names. And eventually, even that list of names will disappear. And it will be as if they never were. And so that's the nature of material forms. So when we try and understand the spiritual form, it's very difficult. So the tendency is to be impersonal and to gravitate towards impersonal philosophy, because that seems more logical. But in this verse, we're reading about the spiritual form of the Lord. They're fantastic.
The Lord's worshipable form, Archa Vigraha, which is installed in temples by authorized acharyas who have realized the Lord in terms of Mantra 7, is non-different from the original form of the Lord.
Can we just read Mantra 7 real quick? Mantra 7 on page 49. One who always sees the living entities as spiritual sparks in quality one with the Lord becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? So this is a description of the topmost devotee. So Prabhupada is saying that this type of person who sees every being, every living being as a spiritual spark, and one in quality with the Lord, he becomes a true knower of things. So he's saying that type of devotee actually has an experience of the personal form of the Lord eventually in their progress. And they're called acharyas, and they've established the worship of the Lord in his archa form. That was the mantra you wanted to read, yeah.
Yeah. This is good
too. Next time.
Yeah. The Lord's original form is that of Shri Krishna, and Shri Krishna expands himself into an unlimited number of forms such as Baladeva, Rama, Nrisimha, and Varaha. All of these forms are one and the same personality of Godhead. Similarly, the Archivigraha form worshipped in temples is also an expanded form of the Lord. By worshipping the Archivigraha, one can at once approach the Lord, who accepts the service of a devotee by his omnipotent energy. The Archivigraha of the Lord descends at the request of the Acharyas, the holy teachers, and works exactly in the original way of the Lord by virtue of the Lord's omnipotence. Foolish people who have no knowledge of Sri Isha Upanishad or any of the other Shruti mantras consider the Archivigraha, which is worshipped by pure devotees, to be made of material elements. This form may be seen as material by the imperfect eyes of foolish people or Kanishta Adhikaris, but such people do not know that the Lord, being omnipotent and omniscient, can transform matter into spirit and spirit into matter as he desires.
Yes. Okay.
Well, I know in the Christian religion, some of the people that were traveling with Moses, they started worshiping a golden calf. And so it says, do not worship idols. And it's a big thing in the Christian religion, do not worship idols. So when they see the way that we're worshiping, they think that it's idols. Can you tell me the difference and why this is not idol worship?
Okay, thank you. Good question. Also in the, of course, Jewish religion and also Muslim religion, it's prohibited to worship idols. And that's exactly why, is because at that time in those religions, at the time of those religions came about, people were worshiping imaginary forms of what they considered demigods or the supreme. You find it a lot like in Egypt and those areas. Prabhupada said that actually those cultures were break-offs from the original Vedic culture and gradually developed in some other way. So the point is that there is a form of the Lord, but you cannot imagine a form and begin to worship that form. So better not make a form if you're going to imagine a form. And so that prohibition is actually a good thing for those religions. But the thing is the Lord does have a form, and if that form comes to you in an authorized way through self-realized acharyas who have seen the form of the Lord, and in the Vedic mantras the form of the Lord is described, and how to make the form of the Lord is scientifically described. And so one can make a form of the Lord. And then the Lord, because he is the controller of all energies and everything, is nothing is separate from the Lord, he can manifest in the material. Actually, material energy is also just, you could say, a mental concept, because it's just a presentation of illusion to us. You know, for the Lord, everything is spiritual. And for the self-realized person, everything is spiritual. And even from a scientific point of view, and I've said this before, if you analyze the atom and you break it down into its smallest component, there actually is nothing material that they can find. All they can find is vibrating light. Yeah. And so it's the illusionary energy of the Lord. So for the Lord, everything is spiritual. And for the devotee who sees everything in relationship to the Lord, there's nothing material. And so sometimes they say, well, you know, the Lord is everywhere, therefore you don't need to go to the temple to worship the Lord. And we say, yeah, the Lord is everywhere, and you can find him everywhere. But he's also in the temple too, so why not come worship him in the temple as well? So the deity worship we perform is not imaginary. It's not like that we've created an imaginary conception of the Lord and then made a form, but the form that we're worshiping is coming down to us through the scriptures and through self-realized souls. All right.
just said about the when we divide the atom, then we find the light there.
Yeah.
So, can you tell more about that? Is this something that they figured out, scientists?
Well, it's a theory. It's a mathematical theory called quantum theory, quantum mechanics. It's called a string theory. And if you Google string theory and read about it, you can find more details. But in science, that's the accepted theory these days. And it's a mathematical equation. And so you take the smallest parts with according to the theory and to the math and to experiments they perform with atom smashers. They find that there's only vibrating light that look like little strings, and there is no material substance. Yeah. And you could, even the material substances we have are all made of the one same energy of an atom, right? There's different types of atoms and there's different types of molecules that make up a molecule, right? Well, just like we can say the atom of hydrogen, right, is one proton and one electron. And then oxygen is two protons and two electrons, right? But they're the same electrons and the same protons, they're just more in number, right? And then you have carbon, which is four protons and four electrons, and sometimes they share electrons and they join together and they make a molecule, right? But the basic building block, this is the same one energy. There's no variety in it at all. But just by a combination of the atoms in geometric relationship to each other, you might have water or you might have, wood, or you might have a rock, or you might have fire, and you have the different elements. And even when it describes in the Bhagavatam the material creation from subtle to gross, how one element builds upon the other, it still goes back to one energy. And sometimes the material energy is called Brahman. It's referred to as Brahman because it is one energy. And it says in the Bhagavatam that this energy is one. It's Advaya Jnanam. But then it can also be realized as Paramatma or Bhagavan. And so the whole idea of material and spiritual is it's for us who have this, who are conditioned by the material illusion. But for a self-realized soul, they're not conditioned by this illusion anymore, so they see spiritual and they see the form of the Lord everywhere, in the atom and also in the deity, and not different. So they're bowing down to everything, to the Paramatma everywhere, or to the form of Bhagavan. So Google string theory.
One more question came to the mind that even the Uttamadhikari when he preaches, then he has to distinguish. So how does he like respect and at the same time be strong in the preaching, like smashing really the Mayavadi impersonal concepts like what Prabhupada did, and at the same time, be respectful. So what is that which such a person, or like if we are trying to follow in the footsteps, then how we should act, that we preach also strongly and at the same time develop a vision to see everything as being spiritual.
Thank you. Okay, so there's two questions there, I guess. And the first is that how is it that, for those of you who may not know, we were talking about this before, there's three classes of devotees, and the topmost class of devotee is called the Uttama Adhikari, or sometimes the Mahabhagavata, and these names can be confusing because there are some distinctions. But anyway, it means one who sees the Lord everywhere, and he sees every being in relationship to the Lord, and he doesn't really see any maya. He sees everyone as a servant of the Lord, and therefore there's no problem, and you know, there's nothing to be adjusted. So there's really no need to preach. But it says that once in a while, generally those who are preaching are considered the second class devotees or the Madhyamadhikaris, and they make a distinction. They see the innocent, they see the envious, they see the devotees, and they see the Lord. And so they're making distinctions. They say, oh, this person's in maya, this person's not in maya. This person hates the Lord. This person is just innocent. They're ignorant. Let me try and help them. And that's their motivation, right? So Prabhuji's question is how is it that a first-class devotee who has this vision that everything is, you know, the Lord is everywhere and everyone's in relationship with the Lord and everything is spiritual and there's not a problem, how is it, you know, that they take up the business of teaching others? And so it's simply out of compassion, and it's because they're on a higher level. They can come down to a lower level, and it doesn't mean that they lose that higher level. It's just like if you're on the third floor of a building, you can look down and you can see the second floor and you can see the first floor. If you're on the first floor, you can't really see what's on the second floor or the third floor. So therefore it said, now it comes to your second question, you know, how do we have that preaching spirit? And we should take up the spirit, you know, of our spiritual master and preach in the way that he does, but according to our capacity and according to our realization. So it's said that we shouldn't imitate the advanced devotees. We shouldn't try and pretend that we're like them, but according to our capacity, we should explain things. Prabhupada says that we should read and understand the teachings, and then in our own words, we should explain it to somebody else. So we should digest something, and according to what we've digested, that's what we can give to somebody else. And we can just give them a book, and they can read for themselves also. So does that answer your questions?
There was a little kind of a dilemma. When we read about certain conversations of Prabhupada, where Prabhupada says very strongly, do not compromise. As soon as you compromise, you will fall down. And then Prabhupada says that it is better to have an intelligent enemy than a foolish friend. Prabhupada says very strongly that how you should basically go out and preach. When it comes to practical application, when we apply it in our life, as we don't have that realization, so we always lack short of, you know, that convincing the other people with that. And then there are places where many ISKCON devotees, senior sannyasis, who say that even if you are not successful, that is fine. Just carry on. Don't deviate from the things. Speak strongly. So it becomes a little bit a dilemma that we don't want to imitate Prabhupada, but we want to carry the same mood that he had so that the things don't get watered down. It doesn't get diluted. Otherwise, over the period of time, we start taking it as a normal ritual. And at the same time, when we apply it, it becomes difficult to apply it because we don't have that faith and conviction. And we are not able to convince the other people that strongly as Prabhupada would do it just in one sentence. So that dilemma is there in the mind, that what way we should take our approach.
Again, you know, you can only fight a battle according to your capacity, right? And according to the weapons that you have. You can't imitate. People appreciate honesty, you know. If someone asks you a question and you don't know the answer, but you try and fake it, you know, they're gonna sense that, and they're gonna doubt you. But if you give the answer according, you know, to your conviction, according to your faith, as best as you can, then people will respect that, even if they don't agree with you. You know, so we can't imitate, and we can't, you know, pretend to have something we don't. But at the same time, we can be faithful to the teachings and to our convictions. But we may not be able to preach as strongly as Srila Prabhupada did in particular situations. And, you know, times are different, and times will always be changing. And, you know, at the time Srila Prabhupada was here, things were in a particular way, especially with the scientists. And it's very different now. And actually, it's a different mood, and different tactics are required. And that will always be the case. Lord Chaitanya, he was a big strategist, you know, and he had a strategy for the impersonalists, you know. Yeah, but we can't imitate him. He did it in a particular way, right? When he was preaching to the impersonalists in Prayag or Varanasi, they're very close together, right? To each other, right? What was Lord Chaitanya's strategy? You know, he sat down where everyone washed their feet, and he became humble pie. But at the same time, he exhibited an effulgence that was much brighter than anybody else in the room. You know, well, you know, we can't do that. We probably can't be as humble, and we can't exhibit an effulgence. And then, you know, before he said a word to the Mayavadis, he got them to surrender in their mood through his humbleness and through his effulgence. And then, you know, through his words as well, he convinced them. And then, you know, he also took sannyas, you know, so that the Smartas and the Mayavadis would also. So, you know, there was a strategy, and it was a particular time and a particular place. So teaching, preaching, it's always going to require that. And we see, you know, within our tradition, you know, that the tradition gradually, things get eroded and become weakened, and you follow a certain formula that worked at a particular time. And eventually, the times change, and that formula doesn't work anymore. And then Acharya comes, and he tips everything upside down, and everyone criticizes that Acharya and says, no, you're doing it wrong. We always used to do it like this, and now you're doing it like that. And then that Acharya, he begins to teach and make many converts. Right? It happened with Bhaktivinoda. You know, people wanted to kill Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the things that he was saying and doing. You know, he was upsetting the balance of power. And the same thing with Bhaktisiddhanta. Just, you know, another generation later, you know, he did things that Bhaktivinoda Thakur didn't do. That the followers of Bhaktivinoda Thakur began to criticize him. And the same thing happened with Srila Prabhupada when he came to the West. So, Prabhupada said that we can't be stereotyped in our preaching or in our teaching. And that's always going to require, you know, a self-effulgent acharya to make those kind of judgments. I'm not saying that we can, on our own, we should change what the acharyas, you know, particularly our spiritual master has taught. But if you look at history and you look at times, you know, that's always required. You know, even in 100 years, 200 years, when, you know, if there are books anymore, now with this iPad coming out. Actually, in Japan, hardly anybody reads books. They all have electronic readers. And they're on the trains reading those. And but, you know, no one's going to understand this English. You know, English will change. The language will change. And the references and the situations will change. And these books will need to be revived. And they'll need to be reinterpreted for the time and the place. And that's going to require empowered devotees to do that. And so we can only teach and we can only preach according to our capacity. And anyone can give out a book or give somebody prasadam or, you know, chant the holy name. But the way we go out in public and, you know, do kirtan may change or it may have to be adjusted. You know, Prabhupada stopped the devotees from doing Harinam in Bombay when they first went there, because it wasn't having an effect. People were just laughing at them. So he started the life membership program, and he said that was the kirtan. You know, and now books, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta saw books as the Brihat Murdanga. But now it's the internet. And who knows, you know, 20 years, 50 years. When we do Harinams, if we go out traditionally in Japan and do a Harinam, the way we do it in India or here, people just walk by like you're not there. It almost has no effect. But if you advertise, you know, that we're going to have, you know, kirtan at a nice hall and make it a musical presentation, then we get more people than we can, you know, we have to turn away people. So, you know, we have to adjust and see what's effective. It's always kirtan, but the way we do it may look very different than the previous generation. Or in a way it was done particularly in according to a certain culture. But whatever, if we're sincere and we do our best according to our capacity, then we can, you know, we can transfer something. Anything to add?
No, I just have a question about you mentioned the self-effulgent Acharya. Was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as such aware of his effulgence? When you said he sat down in a corner, he must be aware, right, that something else was working for him.
Sound very intentional when you read the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Yeah.
And in this day and age, in the absence of a self-effulgent acharya, what would we be doing? Just practicing what the previous acharya has taught, such as what Prabhupada taught, correct? And so when we go out preaching, we would be preaching in the style and the method and the type of lectures and instructions he was giving, correct?
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, we according to our sincerity, the Lord's within the heart and he directs us on how to communicate in a way that somebody else can understand. And it's that way in all learning and all exchange, you know. When a teacher is very, very enthusiastic about the information they want to transfer, they find a way to talk to the student, whether the student is 5 years old or 70 years old. They get the intelligence of, you know, how am I going to explain this information to this person in a way that they can understand it? What language do I have to learn? What level, you know, where are they at? What examples do I need to use that they can relate to this? And so I think that's generally there, you know, in all transfer of knowledge, you know.
The other thing would be that one has also to find appropriate opportunities to preach, because one method we have currently, even go out on book distribution, that is unsolicited. You know, we are just going out, knocking on a door. A person opens. You don't know what their reaction would be. Still, we are preaching. At the same time, if there are really opportunities, some forum where people from our group are invited to give talks or give presentations, those are situations that we should really take advantage of, because there it is that the group that has invited you has decided to come and listen to you. Yeah. So you have an opportunity then to really preach to them.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have to also create these types of opportunities where we can go and preach, as opposed to unsolicited preaching.
I totally agree. You know, sometimes, you know, it's in one sense, it's marketing. Right? So there's targeted marketing, and then there's untargeted marketing. Or, you know, you can shoot the arrow up in the air and see where it lands, or you can aim it and hit the bullseye, you know. But Lord Chaitanya, he did both, you know. He went out into public, and he just indiscriminately distributed this information. And at the same time, you know, he went into the den of the lions, you know, into the center of the Mayavadis and converted them, you know, and the Buddhists and the Muslims. And so, and each time he had a different strategy as well. We should. Okay.
I'm still stuck on the conversation a long time ago about, you were talking about spiritual light, that a human being can only contain so much. Are you saying that as you purify and come to different levels of higher consciousness, that you can contain more spiritual light within the body? And is that why somebody becomes more effulgent? And is that the reason that people pass out and faint when they feel intense love of God, because their body can't contain it?
Yeah, I don't think I mentioned spiritual light. Maybe it's like spiritual ecstasy. So it's mentioned in the Kundalini, Madhurya Kundalini, that as we begin to experience our relationship with the Lord, the ecstasies become so intense that the material body just doesn't have the facility for it. Only the spiritual body, and the spiritual body is developed. So in the spiritual body, where one's spiritual senses become fully manifest, then one can contain the ecstasy. One has the vehicle to experience one's relationship with the Lord fully. But you can't be fully, it's like a snail's body in a Ferrari, you know, and the material body is like a snail. That's all. Yeah. Hare Krishna. I want to finish this purport, and I'd really like to read Bhagavad Gita tonight. We haven't read Bhagavad Gita much these days. Let's just read through this purport, and then if we have any questions at the end, we'll. Yeah. We're on page 58 of Ishopanishad. This verse was about how the Lord doesn't have a material body, like he doesn't have veins and things like that. So we're on 58, right?
Yeah, second paragraph.
Second paragraph.
In the Bhagavad Gita 9.11-12, the Lord regrets the fallen condition of men with little knowledge who deride him because he descends like a man into this world. Such poorly informed persons do not know the omnipotence of the Lord. Thus the Lord does not manifest himself in full to the mental speculators. He can be appreciated only in proportion to one's surrender to him. The fallen condition of the living entities is due entirely to forgetfulness of their relationship with God. In this mantra, as well as in many other Vedic mantras, it is clearly stated that the Lord has been supplying goods to the living entities from time immemorial. A living being desires something, and the Lord supplies the object of that desire in proportion to one's qualification. If a man wants to be a high court judge, he must acquire not only the necessary qualifications, but also the consent of the authority who can award the title of high court judge. The qualifications in themselves are insufficient for one to occupy the post. It must be awarded by some superior authority. Similarly, the Lord awards enjoyment to living entities in proportion to their qualifications. But good qualifications in themselves are not sufficient to enable one to receive awards. The mercy of the Lord is also required. Ordinarily, the living being does not know what to ask from the Lord, nor which post to seek. When the living being comes to know his constitutional position, however, he asks to be accepted into the transcendental association of the Lord in order to render transcendental service unto him. Unfortunately, living beings under the influence of material nature ask for many other things, and they are described in the Bhagavad Gita 2.41 as having divided or splayed intelligence. Spiritual intelligence is one, but mundane intelligence is diverse. In Srimad Bhagavatam 7.5.30-31, it is stated that those who are captivated by the temporary beauties of the external energy forget the real aim of life, which is to go back to Godhead. Forgetting this, one tries to adjust things by various plans and programs, but this is like chewing what has already been chewed. Nonetheless, the Lord is so kind that he allows the forgetful living entity to continue in this way without interference. Thus, this mantra of Sri Shopanishad uses the very appropriate word yathat yataha, indicating that the Lord rewards the living entities just in pursuance of their desires. If a living being wants to go to hell, the Lord allows him to do so without interference. If he wants to go back to Godhead, the Lord helps him. God is described here as Paribhuhu, the greatest of all. No one is greater than or equal to him. Other beings are described here as beggars who ask goods from the Lord. The Lord supplies the things the living entities desire. If the entities were equal to the Lord in potency, if they were omnipotent and omniscient, there would be no question of their begging from the Lord, even for so-called liberation.
That's a very important point, right? Because, you know, the impersonalists say that you're all God, and there's no need to worship God or to ask for anything. But we see in our situation, the fact is that we are dependent. We're not independent, even though we're, in one sense, qualitatively one with God. We're still, you know, we're like the sun ray that's dependent upon the sun, and there's never that independence from that. So it's another way, just another argument or another way of strengthening our faith to understand that. It's true that we're spiritual in nature, but we're not the source. We're nityo nityananam chaitanas chaitananam. You know, that the one supreme, there's one supreme and there's many, you know, of his parts. And there's the one conscious and then there's many little consciousnesses. And there's one eternal and there's many little eternals. But the difference is that one eternal is maintaining all the other eternals.
Real liberation means going back to Godhead. Liberation as conceived by an impersonalist is a myth, and begging for sense gratification has to continue eternally unless the beggar comes to his spiritual senses and realizes his constitutional position. Only the Supreme Lord is self-sufficient. When Lord Krishna appeared on earth 5,000 years ago, he displayed his full manifestation as the personality of Godhead through his various activities. In his childhood, he killed many powerful demons such as Akasura, Bakasura, and Shakatasura, and there was no question of his having acquired such power through any extraneous endeavor. He lifted Govardhana Hill without ever practicing weightlifting. He danced with the gopis without social restriction and without reproach. Although the gopis approached him with a paramour's feelings of love, the relationship between the gopis and Lord Krishna was worshipped even by Lord Chaitanya, who was a strict sannyasi and rigid follower of disciplinary regulations. To confirm that the Lord is always pure and uncontaminated, Sri Shopanishad describes him as Shuddham, antiseptic, and Apapavitam, prophylactic. He is antiseptic in the sense that even an impure thing can become purified just by touching him. The word prophylactic refers to the power of his association. As mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita 9:30-31, a devotee may appear to be a Sudarachara, not well behaved in the beginning, but he should be accepted as pure because he is on the right path. This is due to the prophylactic nature of the Lord's association. The Lord is also a Apapavitam because sin cannot touch him. Even if he acts in a way that appears to be sinful, such actions are all good, for there is no question of his being affected by sin. Because in all circumstances he is Shuddham, most purified, he is often compared to the sun. The sun extracts moisture from many untouchable places on the earth, yet it remains pure. In fact, it purifies obnoxious things by virtue of its sterilizing powers. If the sun, which is a material object, is so powerful, then we can hardly begin to imagine the purifying strength of the all-powerful Lord.
Thank you very much. Yeah. What time does it say there? 7:30. And we have till 8 or 8:30? 8. So Rakshit Prabhu, I just wondered if you could say something about prophylactis.
Well, actually it is a medical term, prophylactic or prophylaxis, which means preventing the recurrence of a disease or a condition. One example that can be given is somebody has a solid tumor or a cancer that is operated upon and removed by surgery. But there is a certain chance that it will recur in the body again. So you could then intervene to prevent that recurrence by giving prophylactic substances or agents. For example, certain vitamins do that. Mm. Vitamin A, just to give an example, was shown several years ago in a medical center in Houston where they had operated people with head and neck cancer, and then they gave them large doses of vitamin A, and they found it prevented recurrence of that head and neck cancer in those who took it as compared to a control group that didn't. So in that case, vitamin A worked as a prophylactic agent preventing the recurrence of that tumor. So in a general sense, prophylactic means to prevent the occurrence of something. Mm. It's preventative.
I see.
And antiseptic is where we had the other word was antiseptic, mm-hmm. Is where it destroys something which has like germ-like properties. So there it's more curative, and prophylactic is preventative.
And the Lord is both. Huh?
That's what it says in the mantra.
So chanting Hare Krishna, because Krishna and his name and form are the same. There's the verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Kali Kali Nama Rupe Krishna Avatar Nama haite haya sarva jagat nishtar. So that it says that the in this age of Kali, the Lord appears, he incarnates in the form of his name. And whoever chants that name, they become freed of the influences of the age of Kali. So whatever influences are there are destroyed in the antiseptic. So the name of the Lord is antiseptic in that respect. And then they're also protected from the influences, so that would be the prophylactic aspect of the Lord as well. So chanting the holy name is not only preventative, but it's also curative. Thank you very much. So now, let's read Bhagavad Gita, and I think we're on chapter 9, right? And we could read the verse, we could read the whole chapter and read a verse in a purport if we're fast, or we could just read some verses and purports, which, let's have a raise of hands. How many people would like to read a whole chapter and read a verse in a purport? Whole chapter. And how many people would just like to read a verse in a chapter? Okay. All right. Let's read the Sanskrit, and then the English. We'll read Sanskrit and then English, so that we can understand what we've chanted. And we start on page. We'll do it all together, huh? 395. Okay, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Let's do it all together. Okay. Idam tu te guyatamam pravakshami anasuyave gyanabhigyana saitam yasgan bhamokshase subha. The personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence. Raja vidya raja guyam pavitam idam uttamam parikshagamanam dharmya sukam kartam amabhyam. This knowledge is the king of education. It is the most secret of secrets. As it gives direct perception of the self by self-realization, it is the perfection of a religion. It is everlasting and is joyfully performed." Ashrada dana purusha dharmasyasya parantapa aprapya mam nivartante mritya samsara vartmani. Those who are not faithful on this path to devotional service cannot obtain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore, they return to the path of birth and death in this material world. Maya tatam idam sarvam jagyara vyakta murtina machtani sarva bhutani nacham tane avashtita. By me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. Nachamachtani bhutani pashyame yogamaisvaram bhuta vrinacha bhutashto mama bhuta vavanaha. Behold my mystical appearance. Yata kasa stito nityam vayur sarvato gomahan tratra sarvani bhutani machta nityanuparaya. All created beings rest in me. Sarva bhutani kunteya prakritim yanti mamakam kapa keve punastani, kapa do visvajamyaham. O son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature. And at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I create them again. Ngim swama vashtabhya, visvijami puna puna, bhuta gramam imam krishnam, avastam prakritir vrsat. The whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again. And under my will, it is annihilated at the end. Dhamsani karmani nibhannanti dhananjaya udasina vadasina asaktam te shukarmasu. O Dhananjaya, all this work cannot bind me. I am ever detached from all these material activities, seated as though neutral. Maya dakshina prakriti suyate sacharacharam hetuna nena kunteya jagad viparivartate. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. Nantima mudha manusim tanumaristam parambhavam ajananto mamabhuta maheshwaram. Fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the Supreme Lord of all that be. Mogosa moga karmano mogo gyana vichetasa rakshase masarim chaiva prakritim oinim shrita. Those who are thus bewildered are attracted by demoniac and atheistic views. In that deluded condition, their hopes for liberation, their fruit of activities, and their cultural knowledge are all defeated. Mahatmanas tamam partha daivim prakritim arista pajanti ananya manaso ganfabhutadam avyayam. O son of Prita, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. Satatam kirtayantomam itantyastra dridavrata namasyantastamam bhakya nitya yuktu upasate. Always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. Yanye yanyanto mamupasate ikatvena pitadvena buddha bhavato mamakam. Others who engage in the sacrifice of the cultivation of knowledge worship the Supreme Lord as the one without a second, as diverse in many and in the universal form. Aham kraturaham yajna swadhanam aham asadam matroham aham mejam aham agnir aham hutam. I who am the ritual, I am the sacrifice, the offering to the ancestors, the healing herb, the transcendental chant. I am the butter and the fire of the offering. Pitaham asyam jagato matadatta pitamahan vedya pavitram omkara riksamaya jarevacha. I am the father of this universe, the mother, the support, and the grandsire. I am the object of knowledge, the purifier, and the syllable Om. I am also the Rig, the Sama, and the Yajur Vedas. Shri Nivasa Sarana Hrisrit Prabhava Pralayashtanam Nidanam Bijamabhyam. The sustainer, the master, the witness, the abode, the refuge, and the dearmost friend. I am the creation and the annihilation, the basis of everything, the resting place and the eternal seed. Tapamahamaham varsham nigraham vijaman vacha amritam chaiva mritischa sadasachcha marjuna. And I withhold and send forth the rain. I am immortality, and I am also death personified. Both the spirit and matter are in me. Trivedyamam somapapatapapam yagner ishra sarvam gitam partayante te punyam asadam asurinder lokam asnanti divyan devi deva bogan. Those who study the Vedas and drink the soma juice, seeking the heavenly planets, worship me indirectly. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planet of Indra, where they enjoy godly delights. Shine punye marcha lokam vishanti evam trai dharma manupranam gata gatam kama kamala bante. Vast heavenly sense pleasure and the results of their pious activities are exhausted. They return to this mortal planet again. Thus, those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas achieve only repeated birth and death. Ananyas chintantomam yejana payupasate tesham nityabayuktanam yogashemam vahamyaham. But those who always worship me with the exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack, and I preserve what they have. Ye pyapyanya deva bhaktya yajante sharayan vitam tepi mam eva kunteya yajantya vidipurvakam. Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith actually worship only me, O son of Kunti, but they do not, they do it in the wrong way. Ahami sarva yagnanam bhokta cha prabhareva cha natu mam abhijananti tatvainantas chivantyate. I am the only enjoyer and the master of all sacrifices. Therefore, those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down. Yanti kunteya yanti mabhyajinopimam. Those who worship the demigods will take birth amongst the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship the ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me. Yo me bhakya prayachati tadaham bhakya paritam asnami prayatatmanaha. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, I will accept it. Yadanyasi yasjuhosi dadasi yat yatapasyasi kunteya tatgaraswa madarpanam. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer and give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering unto me. Mokshase karma bandhasa sannyasa yoga yuktatma vimukto mamupashasi. In this way you will be freed from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious results. With your mind fixed on me and this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated and come to me. Bhuteshu name dveshos dinatriyaha ye bhajanti tamam bhakya mayi te te shuchapyaham. No, am I partial to anyone. Oh. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend and is in me, and I am also a friend to him. Api chet suraracharo bhajate mam ananya bhak sadhureva samantavya samyag vyavastito isa. Even if one commits the most abominable action, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly because he is properly situated in his determination. Sasvas chantim nigachanti kuntiya pratijanihi Name bhaktya pranashyati. He quickly becomes righteous and he attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. Mamhi parta papashvitya yepi su papayonaya sriyo vaishastata sudras tepi yanti param gatim. O son of Prita, those who take shelter in me, though they be of lower birth, women, vaishyas, merchants, and sudras, workers, can attain the supreme destination. Bhaktya rajarshaya tata anityam asukam lokam imam prapya bhavashramam. How much more this is so of the righteous Brahmins, the devotees, and the saintly kings. Therefore, having come to this temporary miserable world, engage in loving service unto me. Manamava madbhakto majajimam namaskuru shashi yuktvainam atmanam matparayanaha. Always in thinking of me, become my devotee and offer obeisances to me. Worship me, being completely absorbed in me. Surely you will come to me. Hare Krishna. Chapter 9, Ki Jai. The most confidential knowledge. So, how are we going to pick a verse in a purport?
27.
Well, yeah. He who hesitates is lost. So, 27. Okay. That's on page 432. So, Zoe, why don't you read?
Yet karosi yad ashnasi, yet juhosi dadasiya, yet tapasyasi kaunteya, tat kurushva madarpanam.
We need to use the microphone so that the kitchen staff can hear us and the people in the back room. I asked Zoe to read. Okay. Well, why don't you guys do junk and pa? You know how to do that?
I thought you just... Yet karosi yad ashnasi, yad juhosi dadasi yad, yad tapasyasi kaunteya, tat kurusva madarpanam. Should you read the purport?
Word for word, and then the verse, and then the purport.
Yes. Yet whatever karosi you do, yet whatever ashnasi you eat, yet whatever juhosi you offer, dadasi you give away, yet whatever tapasyasi austerities you perform, kaunteya a son of Kunti, tat that kurusva do mat onto me, arpanam as an offering. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering to me. Purport. Thus, it is the duty of everyone to mold his life in such a way that he will not forget Krishna in any circumstance. Everyone has to work for maintenance of his body and soul together. And Krishna recommends herein that one should work for him. Everyone has to eat something to live. Therefore, he should accept the remnants of foodstuffs offered to Krishna. Any civilized man has to perform some religious ritualistic ceremonies. Therefore, Krishna recommends, do it for me. And this is called archana. Everyone has a tendency to give something in charity. Krishna says, give it to me. This means that all surplus money accumulated should be utilized in furthering the Krishna consciousness movement. Nowadays, people are very much inclined to the meditational process, which is not practical in this age. But if one practices meditating on Krishna 24 hours a day, by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra round his heads,
his beads.
Round his beads, he surely the greatest meditator and the greatest yogi, as substantiated by the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita.
Jai, thank you very much. So, Zoe, why did you pick this verse?
I was just thinking about people's jobs and their activities. Say somebody is a bartender or works in a slaughterhouse, can they offer their work to Krishna?
Also, you turn that into a question.
Exactly.
So when you read this verse, it brought up this question in your mind. So if somebody works in a slaughterhouse, or if they're a bartender and they're offering drinks and intoxication to people, how can your question is can they still be working for Krishna, or practically speaking, how could they do that? Right. So does anybody have an answer? What do you think? Rakshit problem?
I think, firstly, something may have to be said about the nature of work that one has chosen, whether that could be offered to Krishna. Krishna does express his preferences with respect to the type of food that he wants to be offered. For example, in that verse that we read, Patram Pushpam Toyam, give me a fruit, a flower, or a leaf, and I will accept it. And there, he's essentially expressing preference for things which are in nature, that is, from plants, vegetables, and things like that. Prabhupada has commented in his many commentaries that in nature, the cow gives milk, you have grains that you get from plants, and there is all these things available. So why slaughter animals and eat them? And one can also ask, would Krishna find that to be palatable if one is doing that work as working as in a slaughterhouse and then says, I'd like to offer my work to Krishna, that if that person was in knowledge as to what Krishna wants or likes, he would think it over whether he would like to offer it to him. It's one comment.
So basically what you're saying is you turn the question into another question, or you brought it to the point that the person who's engaged in working in the bar or working in the slaughterhouse should question their line of work from the beginning. Rather than asking how they can use that to work for Krishna, they should be asking the question, is this the kind of work I should be doing at all for Krishna? Right? Okay. Anything else? Well, you know, in this world, even at the time of Lord Krishna, there were those who took intoxication. In fact, even the Kshatriyas used to take a little intoxication, I think. And they even went out and hunted animals and ate them sometimes. There's always going to be people who are eating meat and taking intoxication. So the question is still, what if a person, and actually, you know, a lot of us know what Krishna wants, but does that mean we always do it? I mean, that's a pretty gross example of eating meat, but I mean, on a subtler level, there's times in our life where I'm sure I can only speak for myself, where I know Krishna Prabhupada wanted this way and I'm doing it that way. So it's good to be aware. Even if we're not up to the standard, we should at least be aware of what the standard is and be honest. But if a person, I'm trying to think of examples of devotees of Krishna that kind of offered their services. Kubja She offered herself to Krishna. She was a prostitute, and anyway, what I wanted to say is just say we may know what the standard is, but for some reason or another, due to weakness or due to socioeconomic situation, somehow maybe we can't, we just cannot come up to that. Can the person still dovetail their work for Krishna, even if it's kind of sinful work? And I propose to say, yes. We can offer the fruits of our work to Krishna, even if... use the microphone, please. Just like you're eating an ice cream cone.
And I completely agree with you.
Chocolate and vanilla?
Yeah. Maybe I'm rationalizing a little bit. Because in the line of work that we work, most of the time, unknowingly, we end up abating the things that Krishna doesn't like. In my previous job, I used to work for a company called NVIDIA, where the primary job was to enable rich applications. I mean, I could always rationalize that they could be used for medicine and other things, but primarily, most of the revenue used to come from gaming. First-person shooter games, which are completely violent. But
gaming, you mean like gambling and things?
Gaming, like in video games.
Oh.
So, and I didn't...
That's a kind of intoxication, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. today, I mean, I left that job and I moved into another role. But even in that role, inadvertently, now I help a company that does horse racing. I help a company build a network for Kentucky Derby.
From gambling.
Yeah, gambling. I mean, so is one better than the other? I don't know. I mean, this is my duty, right? Just like a soldier's duty is to fight, my duty is to do my job. I mean, in the best possible way, and whatever I learn, earn, and do, I want to do it for Krishna. And that is what keeps me motivated. That's what keeps me high. That's what makes me come here. I don't see why a slaughterhouse operator or a bartender who serves wine and whatever cannot pray Krishna. Because if you're doing it as an activity...
Well, one thing is to pray to Krishna. Sorry to interrupt you, but... But practically speaking, how do you offer your work to Krishna?
When you don't, the idea is when you don't, when you are not attached to the results, right? That is what we are taught. You just keep working and have Krishna in the back of your mind while you're doing the work. And that is how I offer my work to Krishna.
Oh, that sounds pretty easy.
It is very... It turned out to be very difficult.
That doesn't sound very painful.
It doesn't. It actually doesn't.
Doesn't hurt at all.
It used to. Initially. Very initial stages. Okay.
So can somebody think of another way that you might... Maybe a more practical way or a more concrete way of offering your work to Krishna? How is that offering the fruit? Krishna says offer the fruit of your labor. Isn't that real detachment? You can mentally say I'm not detached, but you know, keep $100,000 in the bank.
Yeah, we do it all the time, right?
Is that on? Well, that's a nice one. I like that.
I think my
Okay. Well, I guess your time's up.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to hear from somebody else how, practically speaking, we can demonstrate our detachment to Krishna in a practical way. I'm just going to say that practically we should be offering some of the fruit of our work to Krishna, even if we're a bartender or unfortunately we have to be working in a slaughterhouse. But, or, you know, somehow, you know, our work is not, I mean, there used to be parts of my job, sometimes I still really wonder about it, you know, resuscitating people that don't want to be resuscitated, or old people that were definitely, it was time to leave their body, and we come in and disturb that situation. You know, it's, there's always something about work that's impure and that has some negative karmic effects to it, you know. But still, we should be thinking that Krishna has given me this opportunity. I need to make a livelihood, and we should give some of the fruits of our labor, you know, to Krishna. And in the Christian church, they call it tithing, and a tithe means 10%. Actually, they call it tithing, but tithe itself, the word, means 10%. So, to give 10% of your income, you know, for the service of the Lord, it's a little pinching, you know, especially when times are tight. You know, but a lot of Christians do that, and that's something real and practical. Prabhupada suggested 50%, actually. Maybe 10% is you know, possible. 50% is that would be very surrendered. But the idea is, if you give something, and I heard Prabhupada give the example as like when we offer food to the deity, offer what you eat, like they're making an offering now, right? So there's a certain amount of food on the plate, right? But back in the kitchen, there's a big pot. Right? But we're actually only offering a little plate to Krishna right now. So what about all the food that's in the pot? So when we offer the plate to Krishna, that whole pot is considered part of the offering. So that becomes prasadam. So when we work for Krishna, when we offer the fruits of our labor sincerely to Krishna, we give something for the Sankirtan movement, just like practically, the book distribution here at ISV is a large proportion of it is supported by the congregational members who are offering the hard fruits of their labor to support the Sankirtan movement for the pleasure of Srila Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya. And so that purifies your work. All of your work, all of your money becomes purified, becomes prasadam when you offer that fruit. Sincerely for the service of the Lord. So that's how I would answer that. That in this material world, nothing is ideal or utopian. But according to our sincerity, whatever we offer to the Lord, if we're, you know, a multi-billionaire and we offer $1 to the Lord, it's not very sincere. Right? And if we make, you know, $40,000 or $50,000 a year and we offer a couple of $100 a month, That's pretty sincere. And then there's a little pinching there. So if it pinches a little, then you know it's good. There was one point in the purport here I just wanted to bring out here. I thought it was interesting. I've read this purport 100 times and somehow I never noticed it before. But Prabhupada is saying here that when Krishna is saying, all that you do for me, Prabhupada compares it to the rituals of your religion or to doing archana, meaning that we should spend a certain amount of our activity in doing something for the deity. coming to the temple to bow down before the Lord, to be in kirtan and clap before the Lord. It said in the Nectar of Devotion that when you're in the kirtan and you're clapping for the deities, that when you clap and there's a bunch of birds outside, the birds all go flying away. And those birds are like our past sinful activities. So when we're before the Lord and in kirtan, we're raising our arms and we're clapping, all of our sinful activities are going away when one bows down before the lotus feet of the Lord. One becomes purified when we take prasadam and when we bring gifts for the deities and celebrate festivals that honor the appearance day of the Lord, just like Gaur Purnima's coming up. What to speak of going out and doing the Sankirtan Yajna. These are all part of Archana. And so when Krishna says, all that you do, do for me, this is something very practical. So all that you eat, that's obvious. All that you do and your work, that's a little debatable. But this is a very, very practical verse of how to engage your body, mind, and words in the service of the Lord. So is it after 8? I can't see because of the glare. Okay. So any last comments or questions before we end the class? Yes. Microphone. Srinivas. Haribol.
So this brings to one question that we know that we accept that anyone can take to Krishna consciousness. That's what Rupa Goswami speaks and quotes from so many places in Nectar of Devotion. How can one continue with the sinful activities practicing Krishna consciousness? They cannot go hand in hand. So is it not that one has to make the attempt to give up the profession which engages one in sinful activities to take a proper profession so that one does not have to commit sin and then give the fruits to Krishna? While he is engaging in that activity, he can still do it because it's all the matter of consciousness. Is it not that one should actually make an attempt to move to another profession, which is...
Well, of course, it's going back to Rakshit's Prabhu's point, But sometimes it's not always possible. And whatever we do, we can do it really according to our faith and sincerity. And it's not black and white. Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains this. It's brought out in one of the purports in the Isha Upanishad that devotional service is not black and white. It's actually, there's a lot of gray there. And as in the beginning, there's a lot of dark, we're more materially attached. It's maybe 90% for me, 10% for Krishna. But as we engage in devotional service and become purified and our spiritual intelligence awakens and we become fortified in the association of the devotees, then as we awaken, then we make the right choice. We're making wrong choices because of ignorance, due to darkness, and due to past sinful activities and impressions. So as that darkness becomes removed, then we have the eyes to see and the strength to make those choices, but it's usually gradual. And in the end, it will be, 99% for Krishna, 1% for me. And then eventually one forgets all about me. But it's gradual like that. And so you'll find people coming from all different backgrounds. And we see even the Vedas, there's so many prescriptions for all different types of people and different modes of nature. There's 18 Puranas and 6 Puranas for those in the mode of ignorance, 6 Puranas for those in the mode of passion, 6 Puranas for those in the mode of goodness, and then the Bhagavat Purana for those who are Paramahansas, transcendental. So obviously, we want to do right work And Buddhists have this concept as well, too. It's part of the eightfold path of Buddha is a right speech, right work, right frame of mind. I forget, there's eight rights. So thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for... Okay. Well, you should always consider who you're giving charity to, and you should give to a worthy person, or to worthy cause, to a worthy organization. And so you should be aware of the temple you're giving to, and some temples are more bona fide than others. And it's good to have a church and an organization that you're a member of and that you know well. And there you can focus, you know, and put your hard-earned money, you know, to good use because you're aware of the organization and the leaders and how they do things. Just like here, when people give, you know, to the Sankirtan, it all goes to that. We have separate accounts for the temple and for the Sankirtan, and it's there for anyone to see.
The Sankirtan money, for example, goes for the purchase of books. So as devotees donate.
I'm not saying about this.
Yes, no, I'm just giving an example. You bring up a good point. Those monies are used for all activities related to Sankirtan. What devotees spend, for example, in order to make Sankirtan possible, they may buy some equipment, sound equipment, that we use on Harinam. But that's Sankirtan money. They may print flyers, posters, things that we do to advertise Sankirtan. It's all coming from the Sankirtan account. So all the monies from book distribution are used for Sankirtan activities. In the same way, the monies that are coming to the temple in the Hundi are used for operating expenses, running the temple. And we also have the new temple fund, where all the monies that have been collected over the last 7 years are in a savings account, which are put aside for getting a new temple in the future. Yeah. No, so I'm saying that, as Prabhu said, that you have to identify the organization. One has to. Not all temples are bad. There may be some where there are questions. Yes. Yeah. But it's also important for devotees to know how the monies are spent. So yeah. You raise a good question, actually.
It should be transparent.
Yes.
And when you're giving to somebody, Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, there's charity in the mode of ignorance, there's charity in the mode of passion, there's charity in the mode of goodness, and there's transcendental charity. So he says that your donation should it be at least in the mode of goodness, and that means to a worthy person at a worthy time with the proper attitude, you know, at the very least. So that means you have to do your homework, or you have to consider, you know, who is this person? Who is this institution? Who is this temple that I'm giving to? And if you don't know anything about them, then, you know, then it's on you. And so here at ISV, we are very transparent. And and we think that that's good. And even in the world of charity, charitable organizations, you know, like the, you know, like UNESCO or Salvation Army, they all have their books that show you this much money goes for operating expenses, this much goes for food, this much goes for medicine, this much goes for kids' books. And, you know, you can some organizations, they'll say, well, you know, actually 50% of your donations goes to operating expenses, you know, and not that much actually goes to the people in need. So there's all different types of different organizations. So as the giver, well, you know, we should be aware of who we're giving to. Okay. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, assembled devotees ki jai. Nitai Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol.